I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Vivi Marie Vanderputen, and her first collection of poems, Nothing Prepares You, won the Gratian Prize for 2007. And her second collection, which I'm holding in my hands right now, is called Stitch Your Eyelids Shut, and it won the State Library Award in 2011. This other book that I have in my hand is her third collection. It's called Borrowed Dust, and it was shortlisted for that same Gratian Prize. Vivi Marie works at the Open University of Sri Lanka as a lecturer in the Department of Language Studies, and she is in the studio with me today because she is currently on a Fulbright studying here in El Paso, Texas. Vivi Marie, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and I'm so honored to be here.
I'd like to start our interview with having you read a poem on the very last poem of your latest book, Borrowed Dust, and the name of the poem is Dictionary. Can you read that?
Sure. Dictionary. She tried words, but he hardly listened to a word she said. So she picked up a dictionary and threw it at his head.
She picked up a dictionary and threw it at his head. Now, that is fighting with words. Is that what you do? Do you fight with words?
Well, yeah. So language is my thing, right? My studies have been in language, the intersections between society and language. So, yeah, I guess I fight with words and I do everything with words, don't we all?
In the introduction to your book, Stitch Your Eyelids Shut, which is a title I love, by the way, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. The poet, a very well-known Sri Lankan poet, I guess Sri Lankan-American poet, he lives
yes,
in the United States right now, his name
is
Indran Armithanayagam.
Yes.
He writes that your principal subject is life under a state of siege and that you speak for all Sri Lankans. Is that a fair thing to say, that you speak for Sri Lanka?
Well, I like to think that. But as we know, that everything has different angles to it and there are many stories. Mm-hmm. So I think he said that in the context of the 30-year war that raged in Sri Lanka, and a lot of my poetry deals with the war. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I live in the south of the country and the battle mostly raged in the north and east, though we also had our fair share of violence and bomb blasts in the capital city, Colombo, where I live. So essentially my point of view is someone who lived in the city and didn't experience the war in the same way that the people in the north and east experienced it. So I guess you could contest that I speak for all Sri Lankans, but I would like to imagine that I've been sensitive to all parts of the country and how they dealt with the war.
Right. And for our listeners who may not know much about Sri Lanka, what about Sri Lanka needs to be spoken? You alluded to a war. Can you tell us a little about that? I'm sure you're talking about the Civil War.
Yes. Right.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I'm afraid most of us are, you know, might be ignorant about
right,
what happened
okay.
there.
So it's a very, very complex and complicated war, but I'll just simplify it a bit.
Okay.
It was a war between a group called the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, LTTE for short, and the government of Sri Lanka. The LTTE wanted a separate homeland. They wanted their own state of Tamil Eelam. So Eelam means Tamil-speaking homeland. And so they fought for that a very long time. And, of course, the military conflict ended in 2009 with the government. So we lived almost our whole lives with this war, right? Of course, there were many causes for the war. In 1956, after the British left, we were colonized for so long, right? Mm-hmm. So after they left in 1948, 9 years later, in 1956, the then government passed a law which said that Sinhala, that's the language of the majority Sinhala people. Mm-hmm. Sinhala is about 70% of the population and the minorities constitute the rest, so the Tamils and the Muslims. So they made the language of the majority group, Sinhala, the sole official language of the country, and the Tamil-speaking people felt very marginalized,
right,
as they should be. The troubles have been brewing since 1958, And then, you know, it just escalated because the successive majority rule governments ignored the grievances of the Tamil people. Right. So in the end, they formed into a very, very brutal terror group called the LTTE. And, well, the war, it went on and on and ended only in 2009.
Wow. You know, and I'm thinking about the drug wars that happened here on the border. The height of it was in about 2005.
Right.
And before that, there were the murdered women that were found in Juarez. And I'm from California, but I moved here in the year 2000 to teach here at the University of Texas. And I didn't plan on writing about the drug wars, but you can't not write about it. I mean, there must be something that's that you just can't keep quiet. You have to say something.
Exactly, yeah.
When did you know? I know when I first heard about your poetry, the person who highly recommended you was saying that the way you write about war was just blew her away. She thought it was amazing. And when did you know that you had to write about war?
I think it was not even a conscious decision. It just happened because you're responding to all this horrific violence, thousands and thousands of people dead. So I think easily it must be more than 100,000 people killed.
Wow.
And that's like a safe estimate.
Wow.
So in the meantime, there was a Marxist uprising, communist uprising in the south of the country between 87 and 89. So at that point, there were these two major conflicts going in the south and the north of the country. So you just live with it, and that becomes your entire day and night.
Right.
So I think early on I started like writing about it. I must have been about 14 when I wrote about my first poem about a parcel bomb.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, you're a poet and I'm a fiction writer, and I think one of the things that we have in common, writers as opposed to journalists, which is a completely different genre that I don't understand and wouldn't be able to enter into, is that we follow language. Sometimes we don't know what we're going to write, but we hear a voice or we hear a rhythm or or an image strikes us and we follow it. And I think on some level, when there are so many people suffering and dying around you, when you begin to follow language, sometimes those voices enter into your poems and you just can't not write about it.
Exactly.
It's almost irresponsible not to write about it. Because
very true.
Because you would be keeping it out.
Yes.
Making a conscious effort.
Yes.
And that doesn't seem like what we do with poetry. I love your books. I dipped into three of them. I want to go back to your second book, Stitch Your Eyelids Shut, which we had a conversation. You told me that the title comes from a poem by Neruda. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your relationship with Neruda, who also wrote a lot about war. You know, one of my favorite Neruda poems is Explico Algunas Cosas. I explain a few things, where he talks about the civil war that came to Spain and how it affected him and and García Lorca, who was killed. Murdered in that war. So can you talk a little bit about your relationship with Neruda?
So it began when I was in my early 20s, when a professor I was working for part-time gifted me this book because I had done well in my first-year exams.
Oh, that's a great idea. I should do that with my students.
Yeah, and he's a professor of political science in another university, not the university that I was studying in, but I was doing some research for him part-time. So he gave me this book, a very slim book called 20 Love Poems and a Song of Despair.
Oh, yes. It's one of his most famous
amazing.
Books.
Amazing. And he wrote it when he was in his 20s, right?
Yes, yes.
How cool is that? So I just fell in love with him. I mean, there was a time I knew those poems by heart. Of course, it's been some time.
Right.
So that was how it began. And I just love the way he writes about love.
Right.
And yeah, so much of it spoke to me. And you know that Neruda served in the Foreign Office, right? So he was an ambassador.
Right. And he writes poems about that, about his many loves.
Right, that he had many, right? And so there's this amazing thing I have for Neruda's poetry.
Right, nice.
So I was looking for a title for the second book, and I just went through the poems, and I thought there's so much sadness here. Mm-hmm. You know, other people's, my own, my friends. And then I thought, okay, I'm sure there's a poem that Neruda has written, and I found one which is called Ode to Sadness.
Mm.
And that Stitch Your Eyelids Shut is a line from that
Stitch
poem.
Stitch Your Eyelids Shut. That's yeah.
It was
very
also
nice
my image. Way of kind of paying tribute, a humble tribute.
I read somewhere that another one of your poetic influences was Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
You know, she writes in a way that's so empowering to women, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
She's also one of my favorite poets.
Right. And that's quite a juxtaposition. You have the womanizer Neruda on one side.
I know,
you have
right?
The woman activist on the other side.
Yeah, cognitive dissonance, right? I read about Neruda, and I was kind of heartbroken when I read about 2 years ago in his memoirs. He talks about actually it's a kind of a rape.
Yeah.
How he violates this young woman who comes to work for him.
Yeah. Confieso que he vivido is the name of the
his memoir? Biography. Oh, right. The biography.
I confess that I have lived.
Okay. So I read that and I was... And then I thought, you know, there's a way you need to separate art
right.
in a way from the person's life choices, which
right.
you might not... I mean, no one's perfect, of course. But the poet in me is just adores him, right? But the woman in me was like, oh my God, how could you have done that?
Right.
So, yeah, it's a difficult relationship.
Yeah, you know, I taught a Neruda class one time, and I didn't know too much about his biography at the time. I was just, you know, teaching his poems.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I started to do a lot more research.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some very disturbing things in his past. And I'm wondering, how we can separate that kind of conduct from the work in poetry if we can't do it, for example, in the movies, like, you know, Harvey Weinstein, nobody wants to watch his movies anymore, you know?
right.
They may have been good. I'm not quite even sure. But,
it's
a real difficult situation
mm-hmm.
When your heroes, and recently there's been some controversy surrounding Sherman Alexie, that there have been some accusations against him about abusing his position. But Maya Angelou is an incredibly wonderful role model, a great writer.
Yeah, and she's amazing. Yeah.
Later on in the introduction to Stitch Your Eyelids Shut, the poet writes that, and I'm going to quote exactly, you break down, well, you, he doesn't say you, he says Vivi Marie.
Okay, this entrance voice.
Breaks down the august and vain walls of rhetoric built by some poets around their poems. Do you think that poetry can be august and vain and not like bread for the people?
Well, I think there are all types and styles, and there is room for, you know, different styles. So I think he's trying to say in a nice way that the language I use is simple.
Yeah.
So I've got that a lot. People say a word they have used about me, some critics, and I agree with it, is accessible.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Definitely accessible.
Yeah.
Like that poem I had you read at the beginning. She tried words, but he hardly listened to a word she said. So she picked up a dictionary and threw it at his head.
Yeah, that was just me playing a little bit because there's so much darkness in this book.
Right.
You know, so I wanted to make it light. But I think that's what Indran is trying to say.
And do you believe poetry should be accessible?
Not necessarily. I think there are no real hard and fast rules,
right.
but that's just the way I write. Mostly it's deliberate because I want to be accessible. I want to reach people. So while my language might be simple, I like to think that the concepts are not.
Right, absolutely.
And what I'm writing about is gives food for thought and reflection and is complex. But so that is just the way I write, and some people like it. So, you know, lucky
well,
me.
I'm sure a lot of people like it. I like it. So let's talk a little bit about your process. I'm talking to Vivi Marie Vanderpurten, who is in the studio with me because she's on a Fulbright, and maybe we can ask a little bit about that in a while. But I want to stay focused on your poetry for a bit. Can you talk about your writing process from the poem to the book?
There's no one way, but I just keep this little notebook near my bed, and I carry it around with me. So I jot down little ideas that come to my head.
A literal notebook with a literal pen?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
you're old school.
I know, right?
You don't use your notes app in your iPhone?
No. Somehow, poems always begin with pen and paper. And then, of course, I flesh it out on the computer, on my laptop.
Right.
But, sometimes I just make notes. I got a smartphone just 2 years ago, so...
Uh-huh. You were a little behind. You waited a while. You resisted as much as possible.
Yeah, smartphones were also very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, and then it's very different. There's no one process. Some poems have a long gestation period, and I have to work on them. Some come fully formed. So there are times that I wake up in the morning and there's this poem, you know,
just
fully
there,
formed,
waiting,
and I just write it down while I'm...
At those moments, do you feel like you're more a vessel or a creator?
Possibly a bit of both.
Yeah.
And some are just raw, visceral reactions to the violence.
Right.
There's one called Balloon Man in my first book, I think, or the second, I can't remember. But that was in response to a incident back home during the war when a man who used to manufacture and supply balloons for a school party, he made a phone call to the school, and on that same day, I think it was the LTT, had made this call to the school threatening to bomb the school. And because there was a mistake in the phone number tracing, and he was arrested and tortured, and he died.
Yeah.
So,
oh, that's such a sad
absolutely.
Story.
Absolutely.
The juxtaposition of that image of providing balloons.
I know, right? So incidents like that, and the other one about the Central Bank bomb blast in 1996, those were like days where I just heard the news and reacted and just sat down on the same day and wrote.
Wow.
So that, I think, is more like a kind of way to deal with such horror.
And on average, when you write a first draft, how many drafts does it go through before you're ready to publish it?
I don't know, 4 or 5. Some poems more than the others.
What's the longest you've ever worked on a single poem?
Sometimes months.
Months, wow.
Yeah. I can't write every day. I'm not one of those disciplined people who writes a little every day.
Do you write at least once a week?
I try to, but there are some months where there's nothing.
Months?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Don't you go crazy?
I know, right? And I feel I should be writing, but I think you just have... Sometimes you just have to wait till poetry comes to you.
You know, I had this poet on the show. His name's Marcus Wicker, fantastic United States African-American poet. And I asked him about his writing process, and what his answer surprised me. He says he only writes 2 days a week, period.
Okay.
You know, the other times, though, he carries a notebook like you and writes stuff down. But then, so it's 2 days a week when he, and I thought that's interesting because I, as a writer, I try to write every day except for Saturday and Sunday. I don't do that. Saturday is my day of rest, and Sunday is a day to spend with family. But I thought that was interesting. And what he suggested is that the whole week he's taking notes and he's thinking about lines. Mm-hmm. And so when he does write, it just comes out. It pours out of the page.
Right.
And does that happen to you? I mean, going without writing for a month and yet keeping notes, I imagine sometimes it pours out of you.
Sometimes it does. But see, okay, my day job is also quite strenuous. The teaching, the research, the grading and all that. And for 3 years, from 2013 to 2016, I was head of department. You call it chair here,
wow.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So the administration was so numbing.
Tell me about
yeah.
it.
So it's just, yeah. And during that time, I used to write like an escape, but sometimes administration is hardly the inspiration for poetry.
Oh, geez. Yeah, tell me about it. You know, our mutual friend Maurice, who works in the English department and is now an associate dean, was telling me the other day that she looked a little tired. I go, "You okay?" And she says, "Well, I was up till like 3, 4 a.m. I go, "What were you doing?" She goes, "I was writing."
Mm-hmm.
She goes, "Something was due." You know, it's anthology, I guess, she was involved with.
Okay.
And I thought, that's crazy. I don't know how you can be an administrator and a writer at the same time. It's really demanding.
It's hard. It's hard,
wow.
yeah.
So you write poems. Sometimes you you revise them multiple times. Sometimes they come out. Sometimes they're, you know, you have to force them out a little bit more.
Yeah.
How do you know when you have written a book? And is there a point when you're writing a bunch of poems when you realize, oh, I see the shape of the book? Like, I see Stitch Your Eyelid Shut as a book. I see Borrowed Dust as a book, not just an arbitrary collection of poems, but a book with shape and with form.
Right.
At what point in the process of getting all these poems together do you realize the concept of the book?
I think after many revisions, and you feel you cannot revise them anymore. Putting the collection together for me seems to have been a little arbitrary, because I write about the war and love, and so there's personal, there's no like one theme, though some themes may dominate. Yeah, so I think it's after I have revised them and feel that I can't do it anymore, then I kind of put them together.
It's interesting. I'm thinking of a quote that I encountered that was attributed to Neruda, Pablo Neruda, who we were talking about earlier. And I don't know how apocryphal this quote is, but it was by a very well-known Chicano poet who was saying that Neruda says, "I don't write poems, I write books."
Oh, wow. Okay.
Do you write poems or do you write books?
I think I just write poems.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remain very, very critical, self-critical.
Right.
So I'm never quite sure. I know it's not very cool to be like that, but I'm never quite sure whether it's okay.
I've had great poets like W.S. Shapiro on this show, and I ask him that question too, and he says, "No, I don't write according to a theme. I write poems, and then and then there's the book." I mean, everybody has their own process.
Absolutely, and I remain very critical. So sometimes, even after it's published, I think about things that never came to me during the revision, and I'm like, oh my God.
I wish I could have done that.
Yes. Yeah.
How that feels.
Yeah. So that happens
too. It's funny because I had a novel come out recently, and I was doing a reading, and as I was reading it, I thought, that's not a very good sentence. I want to revise that.
Yeah, but too late, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a fiction writer, and I think what I love most is really short fiction. I love short fiction, and sometimes very short fiction. And when I'm working on a book or when I'm working on stories, there's a certain point where I have a bunch of stories and I thought, oh, my God, they make a book. But once I recognize that there's a book, then I start understanding how the stories are linked.
Oh, right.
And I might bring those things out, you know, and even eliminate certain stories.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever come up with a book and you've seen a poem and you said, well, no, this poem doesn't fit? Or you see there needs to be a poem that isn't there and that you have to write for that book?
I've seen poems that should not be there and deleted them out. But no, I haven't experienced that yet, you said after.
Well, your poems, they hold up as books. I mean, and I think that's just something us writers do, consciously or not. But let me ask you another thing. We're unfortunately running out of time, and I wish we had more because there's so much to talk about. But I know you're in El Paso. And you're here on a Fulbright. Can you talk a little bit about your research, what it is you're doing here? Why El Paso?
Okay.
Why did we get lucky to have you here?
Well, actually, it was quite a coincidence. I saw this advertisement asking for Fulbright applications for short term. And well, I had never been to the United States
before.
Wow,
really? This is your
first
time?
Yeah, this is my first time.
Wow, and it's the first time you come to the United States, you're basically in Mexico. Awesome.
And why not, huh? Yeah, my local mobile phone company, I got a roaming number, right? So when I sit in my office in room 311 in Hudspeth,
it picks up a Mexican carrier.
Yeah, and it sends me a notice in Sinhalese which says, welcome to Mexico, right?
My office used to be in Hudspeth. It happened all the time.
All the time.
And this was before the rates were so separate. I mean, right now you can make certain calls and it's not that expensive. But I remember one time I got a $400 bill in 1 month because I had made all these calls out of Mexico, which wasn't true. I fought for it and won. But that's we are so close to Mexico and even culturally speaking. you walk through campus, you hear as much Spanish as you do English.
Yeah, that's lovely though.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, why not El Paso? And I knew Maris Jayasurya from, so she had contacted me in 2011 asking me for permission to reproduce some of my poems in the book she was writing.
She loves your poetry, absolutely.
Yeah, Terror and Reconciliation in Sri Lankan Anglophone Literature. And then we stayed in touch after that, and then she started teaching some of my poems in her post-colonial literature classes. And because of that, I thought, okay, well, there's a connection here.
Right.
And I'll come over. And so I applied. I didn't really think I'll get the Fulbright because it was quite competitive. But, well, I got it, and I guess I was lucky. And the fact that I'd had my master's and PhD education all in the UK. So I said, why not go to the United States?
Well, I'm glad you came. Welcome here. I got to ask, have you been to Chico's Tacos yet?
No.
Well, I hope somebody takes you there. Well, I don't want to, get El Paso people angry and give you my opinion on the food there, but people love it here.
Yeah.
And they always tell you to drink the juice.
Okay.
Yeah, they're basically rolled tacos, smothered with cheese and inside a bath of juice, and you're supposed to drink the juice.
Okay, that sounds like fun.
Well, I'm not sure it's the most representative example of El Paso cuisine, but I'm really glad you're here, and I love your poetry. Can we end with having you read a poem?
Okay, I'll read one.
This is Vivi Marie Vanderpruten, who's going to read from her book, Stitch Your Eyelids Shut. Oh, you're going to read Extraordinary.
Yeah, because you liked it.
Yes,
right?
I do like that one.
Okay. So this is called Extraordinary. I discover you suddenly, unexpectedly, in cyberspace. Your smile appears in a Yahoo avatar I click on by mistake. Shocking how a mere picture can explode into a million pixels of pain. I'm at once dizzy with grief that I lost you. When the room stops turning, I look again at your picture. On I Feel Brave Today days, I contemplate your ways, and it dawns on me you were neither extraordinarily cute nor extraordinarily sensitive nor any kind of funny. Not even smart. It dawns on me that you weren't extraordinary at all, another brick in the wall, but that I loved you extraordinarily, and that's why I'm dizzy with grief that I lost you.
That was Vivi Marie Vanderpruten from her book Stitch Your Eyelids Shut. Love and War. What else is there? Love and War. Thank you so much for sharing your poetry and your thoughts with us, and I hope you enjoy your time in El Paso.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank Vivi Marie Vanderpruten for joining us on Words on a Wire. And I'd like to thank, as always, our fantastic, extraordinary producer, Lauren Terrazas. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.